Hello, and welcome to Podcasts on Germany and the Number 10 podcast. I'm Chris.
Hi, and I'm Jacob.
And we're here to do a swap cast today about Armistice Day, which is, I think we're going to try and put the episode out tomorrow, Jacob. I'm not sure. You know,
that works with me.
Number 10 obviously focuses very much on British history, and obviously Podcasts on Germany focuses on German history. So we thought we'd come together with our sort of different knowledge areas and talk about Armistice Day of the end of World War One. And I suppose what'd be interesting to start talking about. I mean, out of interest, Jacob, in the schools in the States there, do you guys learn much about World War One? I mean, I imagine you learn a lot about World War Two.
And the U.S. is all about World War Two. we're not involved in World War One enough for us to honestly care about it, sadly. So when it comes to school, especially the high school level, you get maybe like a lesson on World War One, and then we skip ahead to Prohibition and the Roaring Twenties. And then we go into World War II, which could take a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, it's interesting because I suppose when we start going into like our first topic area, it was the threat of more and more American troops, fresh American troops being landed into Europe, which was one of the reasons why the Germans sued for peace, was because they knew that they were outmatched, they knew they were outnumbered, because there were plenty more soldiers on the way.
Oh, yeah. By the end of the war, I mean, the Americans were the top army involved simply numbers-wise because everyone else had just whittled away their manpower over the last 4 years of destruction. And, absolutely. You know, the Americans have been in since this would be a year and a half at this point. So, yeah, they're fine. They still got plenty of people to go and throw in.
Americans, what the Americans joined the war because was it because of the sinking? It was the sinking of a ship. Was it the sinking of the Lestrania? Was it or?
It was a weird combination. You see, even in American history, we're not 100% sure what we want to say is the cause for America to join the war, because we talk about the Lusitania.
Yes,
but I mean, we didn't join the war because of the Lusitania. We talk about it. But usually we point to two things. We point to the Zimmermann telegram, which, you know, the British have a little bit something to do with that. But we point to the Zimmermann telegram.
We were the ones who found it, weren't we? We were the ones who handed it over to you. We intercepted it, the Zimmermann. Yeah.
We intercepted it our cables. Yeah. You stole it from our cables to give to us, which was a little suspicious.
You're welcome.
So there was that, and then the Germans resuming the unrestricted submarine warfare in hopes of, again, bringing Britain to its knees.
So there was a lot of merchant ships being sunk in the North Atlantic. And just going back to the Zimmermann telegram for listeners who maybe aren't sort of au fait with it, you know, it's quite an important part of American World War One history. But it was the idea that it was Germany and Mexico were thinking about an alliance, and Mexico would get a few of the states, the American states, back, shall we say.
And to be absolutely fair to the Mexicans, they were not planning to join. They were in the middle of their own revolution.
Yeah,
they didn't. Yeah, it was very brutal. They had been invaded by the Americans already, just a little bit prior to this. So they didn't want to get involved in a war against America. And Germany really should have said, no, we didn't send that. But for some reason, they decided to play it honest and admitted to sending the telegram, which blew up in their face.
Yep. Yeah, and as I say, you know, the entry, there are a couple of reasons. I suppose it's less clean cut for America as it may have been for for us, you know, joining the war, for the British joining the war. But I suppose it's, you know, let's talk about where we're at. You know, 1918's an absolutely brutal year of the war, and I think it's one of the highest casualty years of the war. You know, a lot of people think, you know, with the Somme and you know, and sort of
Verdun, and yeah, they point to those big battles as high casualties, but they don't realize that those were focused events that were pushed for a couple of months. This was an entire year of both sides just throwing all their men into it, trying to break each other.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because this trench warfare is just horrific. You know, it's just trying to shoot at a brick wall, really, on each side. You know, so I mean, the Germans kick it off in 1918 with what was known as the Spring Offensive. You know, Kaiserschlacht or the Ludendorff offensive. And I didn't realize the amount of, you know, that was about two, three months. I didn't realize how many people died in it. It's huge. It's like 1.5 million casualties in mm-hmm. like 2 months. You know, where the Germans, you know, fair play. It definitely worked for the Germans. They pushed back Allied groups pretty heavily. But again, it was probably the last time that the Germans were making ground, probably, of the war. This was their last. This is like what, you know, this is a bit like World War II with the Nazis. This was the Ardennes for them. This was the last, you know, advance, and then it sort of retreated from there, really.
To be fair with the Ardennes, you know, that was like a last ditch vain effort. The Spring Offensive did have a chance to work, especially if 1917 was like the year for the Central Powers. Russia's knocked out. They've secured the Balkans. Italy looks like to be on the ropes. And so, you know, the beginning of 1918, they're like, okay, one last push. We knock out France. Britain and the U.S. will come to terms. And so there was this hope, this belief in the country and the soldiers and the leadership that this would work. This was going to be over with. They just needed to make this one big last push. And it does succeed for a while, but while Paris is threatened, it's never on the verge of falling.
Yeah. And that's it. It's, and again, I think it's where you are seeing a lot more troops coming through France. You know, you are seeing obviously a lot more involvement from America as well. But I mean, I suppose for the Germans, this was very much a case of they had to make as much ground as possible. This was their last chance because the Americans hadn't deployed fully. They hadn't, they weren't fully in the war yet, were they? They hadn't all their resources and men and weapons over into the fight. So it was, you know, about getting advantage as much as they could before it was too late, I suppose.
Yeah, the U.S. for World War I and World War II had one of the smallest armies ever, and so once the war once they joined the war, it takes them so long to ramp up and to actually get to fighting strength. And so the Spring Offensive was seen as this is it before the Americans can show up in force. This is where we can break them. There was also the problem for the Germans, though, that even if the Americans weren't going to ramp up in the fall, there was still the problem that the Germans were on their last leg at home as well. Their civilian population was just dying by the thousands. By 1918, they had 800,000 civilians dead from starvation and disease. And they were getting about like 20% of their needed food a day.
What's causing that? I mean, you know, we're not seeing the same kind of. Funny enough, at the moment, I'm reading Ian Kershaw's The End, which is about
such a good book.
Absolutely about the last year for the Nazis from the perspective of Nazi Germany, the last year of World War II for them. And I mean, for them, that last year was horrific from the sense of they were being, you know, the Luftwaffe had been destroyed completely, and they were being bombed to anything. All of their lands that were used for farming were being taken over by the Russians in the east. But was that what was causing the lack of food? Because, I mean, Germany, you know, Britain's nowhere near Germany, really. The Allied forces never really, well, they never did enter Germany, did they, really? I mean, that was the whole point, was the war ended before an invasion as such could really take place.
Well, it's actually thanks to the British that this was so bad. The blockade was blocking everything from entering Germany, including food. And while pretty much turned the entire country into just one giant besieged castle. And so, yeah, no one could get in, but no food was getting in. And eventually they weren't being able to produce enough to keep up with the war effort. And people were starting to die due to nutrition issues.
So where was the food coming? Well, where were they trying to get food from? Who was still supplying them as such?
At the very beginning of the war, it would have been the United States that would have been providing food, or should have been providing food to the Germans. Before the war, Germany usually relied on Russia for a lot of its grains and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
Now that they're at war, that was going to have to be switched over to the United States. But with the British blockade, they were never able to get that fixed. And so they had to rely on their own farming, which couldn't sustain such a full mobilization for 4 years. And so by the winter of 1916, the population started to have to ration everything to the point that they weren't being able to sustain themselves.
It's amazing, really. And I mean, well, I've got a little, you know, going back to the sort of the spring offensive, I've got a map up here of sort of the situation of the Western Front in sort of early March 1918. And again, we're seeing, you know, there were five main kind of drives that the spring offensive pushed for. You had the first one in March, which was the Somme offensive, which managed to gain an incredible amount of land when you think about it. You know, they managed very much to sort of retake 10 quite important villages and towns in sort of like a little cut into the territory. And again, in sort of the second offensive in the north, which was sort of close to Flanders area, and sort of north would have been sort of like Dunkirk. There was quite a lot of ground retaken there. I mean, I can never pronounce it properly, but Ypres, Ypres.
Yes, I always pronounced it when I was younger. Was it Ypres? And then someone pronounced it correctly for me. I was like, oh, okay. I don't see it being spelled that way, but okay.
Yeah, exactly. And again, that third, the third offensive, which was the Eisenhower offensive in May, again, that retook a huge amount of land as well, right next to where the Somme offensive had taken place, as well. And there's two more offensives which sort of, again, just pushed even further through. But a real wedge was cut out. And I mean, when you think this is all trench warfare, you know, this is sort of very, or majority of it, should we say, is trench warfare. It's a pretty heavy win for the Germans, if not only, you know, temporary.
Yeah, it was a big win, but it was such an expensive price. I think it was, what, you said like 1.5 or so million casualties. Yep. And that's not like that's not dealing with pre-war manpower. This is at the very end when they're scraping the barrel. So losing that many men for what is substantial gains, but not a clear victory, is just, it's too much of a cost.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, it's, and then sort of June, July, we're seeing sort of no real massive operations are going on until we get to August of 1918, and we have what's known as the 100-Day Offensive, which was the British, American, French response to the Spring Offensive. I mean, and that would be one of the very worst periods of fighting of the whole of World War One. 1.8 million casualties in 100 days, and just over a million British, French, and American troops. So of that 1.8, 1 million of those were British, French, and American troops that were either captured, killed, or wounded.
Yeah, and it was extremely brutal, not just because trench warfare, but the soldiers really let their aggression out during this last offensive. Americans were angered about rumors about what Germans were doing, and vice versa. There was anyone who was caught with a trench shotgun could expect torture sometimes. The trench shotgun itself, its use in the trench was by the Americans was seen as a huge dishonorable and barbaric move by the Germans. And so everyone was just releasing their fury during this last offensive. And it's probably the most brutal in the sense of person-on-person fighting for the entire Western Front. You always hear about the noble sides, like the pilots and so forth, and, you know, the Christmas truce and so forth. But this last ditch offensive was just all that's erased. It's about killing your opponent.
Well, that's it. And I mean, I think that's very true, because it was the Americans who sort of introduced. I mean, the main shotgun that was used was the model 1987, 1897, should I say? There was the Winchester. Which
went in time and grabbed some.
I mean, you know, the British and the French have been using shotguns throughout the war, but they were, you know, double barrel shotguns, which, when you think about it, when you've got two shots and you've got jamming, you know, in sort of these double barrels, you probably got a bit more of a chance coming up against one of those. But the model 1897, I mean, you've got six or seven rounds there, pump action. You can pretty, you know, a couple people with those, you can clear a trench pretty quickly, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. And they were, the big problem with the shotguns was this, that if you get a rifle shot, it's either going to be a clean kill or it's just one wound you got to deal with the shotgun. It's a gruesome death. It's very bloody. And if you don't die, it's extremely painful.
Indeed, you know, pellets sort of flying into you in all sorts of places. Yeah. You know, when the Germans obviously protested that it was against the Hague Convention on land war, land warfare. They said it was against you know international law to use a shotgun in a trench. Which, I mean, I think when we look at how widespread their use was in World War II, I think that was kind of forgotten. Not really.
Yeah, most of the Hague Conventions. And the Geneva Conventions were usually forgotten about during the wars. They're all nice and good in peace, but apparently when it gets down to actual nitty-gritty of fighting, now they'll use whatever they can.
Yeah. I mean,
the Germans use gas, so.
Well, yeah, well, absolutely, you know, yeah, and that is, I suppose, that's indiscriminate, isn't it? You know, the use of gas, because you're not targeting. The idea is that when your weapons should be targeted, you know, they should target the enemy directly, and I suppose gas doesn't really do that. It can go anywhere, you know, which is there's sort of certain kinds of sort of cluster bombs and that are banned for that very reason, because you can't control where they go. Yeah, you know, so the 100-day offensive pretty swiftly clears up most of that land which the Germans have taken in the spring offensive. And the 100-day offensive ends in November, pretty much really with armistice, with the end of the war. I mean, there was fighting, and I've got some brilliant sort of quotes in that for when we sort of have a look at Armistice Day. But I mean, you're talking, there was fighting up until the very last day. And on that last day, I mean, the line is pretty much right on Germany's border, especially in the south. You know, they are right on the German border by Metz, and they've pushed back almost into Luxembourg. And the fight has almost completely been taken out of France, and it is now in Belgium. Quite a lot of it's in Belgium, or it's on the very border of the Belgian French or the German French border. The German forces are definitely on the run now.
Go ahead.
No, it's fine. Which leads on nicely, I suppose, into Armistice Day itself. So, I mean, you tell me, Jacob. Tell me about Armistice Day.
Well, for the Germans, Armistice Day was extremely late. They were trying to get peace way back at the beginning. They started to talk about it at the beginning of October, and they really started to pursue it halfway through October, thanks to the 14 points and the belief that, you know, we're still fighting the war in the Allied territory. So it's not a defeat. It's an agreement that we're mutually worn out. So if we can end it here, terms will be better than if they make it into Germany.
Yeah.
And so Armistice Day was really, really behind for the Germans. They honestly thought that the Allies would accept terms as soon as possible. And when that didn't happen, they kept trying to switch things around, try to make it more appeasing to the Allies. But on the day of Armistice, it was just a normal day for a lot of the Germans in the very beginning, because the Allies kept pushing. The German soldiers were under constant bombardment all up and down the line as the Allies were trying to get as much territory and, of course, get rid of as much shells as they could onto the enemy. But once the 11th hour hit, along a lot of the trenches, the German soldiers would actually get up knowing that it's over and would turn around and walk, would go back into Germany, because they knew that's what they were supposed to do. And so all up and down the line, you see these German soldiers getting up, some waving, some even running over to say hi to the Americans and the French and the British, but all of them getting up and then turning around and leaving, just abandoning all their trenches, these places that they've spent for the last 4 years of their lives. And for a lot of people, it was, after that 11th hour, it was a sense of relievement and joy spreading throughout the German army. It's a little bit different at home, but we can talk about that in a second. What about for the Allies?
Well, I mean, what's shocking, really, as you say, it is any other day of World War One, and with any other day in World War One, there was a huge amount of casualties and deaths. You know, it was only 11 hours of, you know, obviously on the 11th hour, the fighting would cease. 2,738 men died in that morning. Almost 11,000 were injured on that last day alone. I mean, from a British point of view, the fighting very much did happen up until that very last moment, and there was very much a want to, or a determination, should I say, to keep the pressure on Germany up to the very last minute, to make sure that they were you know, knowing that it was going to happen. I suppose, in some sense, I mean, the U.S. Navy, which were off the sort of in the English Channel, they were firing guns from their they were firing railway guns from their battery, and the last from the ships came at 10:57 into the Verdun area. So they were really right up until the last minute. They were trying to keep the pressure on. I did some reading into sort of the last casualties of the, and there was a few probably really quite sad, you know, cases there. Augustin Trebuchon was the last Frenchman to die in the war, and he was shot on the way, on his way to tell fellow soldiers who were attempting an assault on the Meuse River, which is, I think that's sort of middle of the battle, middle of the line, should we say, sort of between France and Belgium. Mm-hmm. And he was running to tell them that hot soup would be served after the ceasefire. And he was killed at 10:45. This came in. The last British soldier to die was George Edwin Ellison from the 5th Royal Irish Lancers. And he was killed at 9:30 whilst on a scouting mission outside Mons in Belgium, which is right on the front line in sort of the north of the line, it just inside Belgium. The final Canadian and Commonwealth soldier, or British Commonwealth soldier, to die was Private George Lawrence Price, and he was killed by a sniper whilst part of a force advancing into the Belgian town of Ville-sur-Haine, which again is in the north of that battle line. And he was killed 2 minutes before the armistice. And he is recognized as sort of the last killed, and there's a monument on his name. The last American to be killed, and he's sort of widely recognized. If you don't think it was George Lawrence Price, you think it's Henry Gunther, and he was killed 60 seconds before the armistice came in to force whilst charging German troops who were aware that the armistice was nearly upon them. So he, it's a bit of an interesting story with him. I don't know if you've heard this before. He'd had a rank reduction. So he'd been sort of court-martialed. They'd taken away one of his stripes, and he wanted to try and redeem his reputation. And he sort of charged at the German troops. He was shot. And I mean, we don't really talk about it. We don't really think about it in a more general sense. But probably the very last people who were killed in World War One were those fighting in the King's African Rifles in Zambia, in modern day Zambia, because they were fighting for another 2 weeks, you know.
The Germans there did not receive word fast enough. Luckily, they did take the British at their word when they were told that peace had been signed.
Indeed, they had their own armistice ceremony between them, which I imagine would be quite a thing to see, really. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, armistice. So, we talk, obviously, we just talked about, obviously, where 11 a.m. the fighting stopped. And that is, that. I mean, I can't find an example of where the fighting continued beyond 11. And I think that really goes to show that both sides were broken. Both sides were done. They were finished with war. No one wanted to fight on. I don't think anyone had to be told twice, you know.
Yeah, they were all, except for the leadership, all the ground troops were done. They were ready to be over with this. Yeah, for the common soldier, they were done with this. It had been one of the most brutal years of the war. And they, especially for the French and the British and the Germans, it had been a long 4 years and the end was in sight.
Interestingly, in Italy, more soldiers were killed in landslides than by bullets in Italy during World War One.
No, I didn't know that. I mean, I'm not surprised. They were fighting in the Alps. And that's one of my goals, is actually to go and do a tour of the trenches up there.
I bet that'd be very interesting, because they were all sort of along the mountain ridges and the trenches. Yeah, what the planes would do is, obviously the fighting happened in the mountains, but they also happened in the valleys as well, because if you're traveling troops and vehicles, is that, you know, there was the paths through the valleys. What the planes would do is the planes would fly along the top of the mountains at the top of the valleys, and they would drop their bombs, not on the soldiers, but on the mountains, causing landslides. Soldiers would be crushed to death.
Yeah, they recently, I want to say it was maybe 2-3 years ago, but they found a lost section of trench that had a couple of Italian troops buried alive in there.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, I mean, I'll say what I always find is interesting about World War One and World War Two to that extent is every front was so different. The kind of fighting, you know, what was used and that sort of thing. I mean, the Russian, that you know, the Eastern Front with the Russians fighting against the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians, that was a much more vicious, very bloody, just as bloody in World War One, but especially in World War Two. You know, sort of Marshal Zhukov was renowned saying that the Russian army is like a battering ram, and we will just keep throwing resource at it until the door breaks open. And that kind of didn't change from World War One to World War Two in regards to approach. I suppose they did have a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't work out in Russia's favor in the first one, but it sure did in the second one.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, you're right, though. It did. We always think of, when we think of World War One, we're like, oh, okay, trench warfare. But that's really only the Western Front. I mean, on the Eastern Front, there's still a lot of movement. You're dealing more of large armies trying to outflank each other than a stagnant line. In Italy, you do have your trenches, but it's also mountain warfare. So you're having guerrilla tactics and, you know, ambushes and so forth.
Absolutely. And then, you know, you've got obviously the fighting that's happening in the colonies and in Africa and sort of places like that. And that again is completely different to sort of everything else. You know, that's very interesting. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the Eastern Front. You're absolutely right. Again, they are these massive armies that are fighting probably more in ways that we associate World War II as, if you know what I mean, as opposed to World War One, very much as, you know, trench warfare, especially on the British side. But on the Eastern flank, you are seeing a much more flexible, ever-moving line where you're sort of this ebbing and flowing, pushing back and forth. But yeah, you know, so armistice happens at 11 o'clock. It is negotiated in the morning, isn't it? It's about 5 a.m.?
Yeah, it's that they were, it had already been planned for the day it was going to be signed. But they do the final negotiations, if you want to call them negotiations, early that morning.
The photo op.
Yeah. It's a very tragic scene from the German side, versus the Entente, especially the French side. Basically, it's very heroic for them. It's this amazing scene.
Yes, yes. Bring the losing army in and, you know, make them sit down and, you know, yeah, you're very much, you can see in the photos after with like Field Marshal Haig and those, you can see these sort of very triumphant looking photos of them after they'd signed it.
I'm not sure if you've read much about the signing, but for the Germans, they had a couple of people there, mainly representing the new government, the army, the navy, and the representative of the new government, Matthias Erzberger. He's the first one to sign it for the Germans. And he, as he's holding the pen, he stops and he looks at Foch and he tells him, this is a mistake. Signing this treaty, the way you are signing this armistice, the way that you have presented it is a mistake. You are causing more damage than this war has and have ruined a chances for a better peaceful future. And Foch pretty much just says, I don't care, sign the thing. And he does, but he complains about it and he just tells him, it's like, this is going to end poorly for you guys. And Unfortunately for him, it ends poorly for Matthias, because he will be assassinated in the, I think, 20s by the far right, because they blame him for the armistice. They point to him and say, it's because of you we had that armistice and then the Versailles Treaty.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, I suppose... I mean, you know, we'll talk about obviously the November criminals and that, you know, in a but I can't really see much real alternative, but we'll come back to that anyway, you know. So I mean, technically signed 5:12 in the morning in the Compiègne forest. I hope I pronounced that right. Sounded good though, didn't it?
Oh, it definitely sounded good to me. I'm sure we'll hear something from like the French history podcast if we said it wrong.
So the Compiègne forest, it's known as the Compiègne wagon or carriage, is what they signed it in, a train car in the forest. And so there's representatives obviously from the Germans. Were there representatives from other parts of the Triple Alliance there, or was it just Germans?
This is the German surrender. This armistice actually isn't the first of the Central Powers surrendering. It's the last, and that's why it's the most important. The Austrians and the Ottomans and the Bulgarians had actually already surrendered at this point. It's part of the reason why Germany was so willing to sue for peace was that all their allies had lost and abandoned them. So
absolutely. I mean, you know, the Ottomans, they surrendered the month before. I mean, the end of October, they surrendered in Mudros, which again that was the end of hostilities there in the Middle Eastern theater of World War One, and that was between the Ottoman sort of naval head of the navy and the British one of the British admirals on board the HMS Agamemnon, which was after the Greek. He was actually a king in ancient Greece. So the Austrians and the Bulgarians then, are they surrendering quite a bit, or is it all around the same sort of time?
It's all around the same time. I think they surrender after the Ottomans. Don't quote me on it. I don't remember the exact dates, but I know that with this armistice, it's for Germany. It's the very last one. They're the only ones who have any source of strength left in them to keep up the fight.
Yeah, I mean the Ottomans had probably had the worst year out of everyone. If in 1918, I mean, things really started heavily go downhill for them. In 1918, they were sort of opened up on a lot of different. They had a lot of defeats, should we say, in that sort of early 1918. Against sort of Macedonia and other sort of other fronts that they were fighting on. So that German treaty, then the armistice being signed, we had German representatives, we had British representatives, French, and there was an American representative there as well. So we can go through it here. Actually, I've got it here. So for the Allies, there were two signatories. For the Entente, you had the Marshal of France, which was Ferdinand Foch, who was the Allied Supreme Commander. And then you had First Sea Lord Admiral Rosalind Waymus, who was the British representative. And then for Germany, you had, as you said, Matthias Erzberger, who was a politician. You had Count Alfred von
Ubendorf,
ministry. And then you had General Detloff von Winterfeld from the army, and then Captain Ernst Vanzelo from the navy. And then there's three other people there who are all sort of from the Triple Entente, who are kind of like chief of staff or sort of deputy sea lord or British naval officers. They're like assistants to Rosalind Waymus, because you have to travel with an entourage when you've got a four-word title, you see. First sea lord.
Someone's got to be there to present you, you know.
Absolutely. The pen. Give you the pen.
So it looks like Maybe I'm not missing anyone because I had the two for the Allies. I had the four for two for the Entente, four for Germany, and then those three that were there. But none of those look like they're American, so maybe they weren't there.
Which is interesting, really. But I suppose I don't know why they wouldn't be there, really.
Oh, it's probably due to Wilson for one reason or another.
I mean, it could potentially even be that, you know, the Americans may have been kept out of it. I don't know, really. I mean, it's but again, yeah, Wilson was very funny, wasn't he, about a lot of how America was involved in the war, at least from my knowledge.
Oh, yes, he's. I'm not a huge fan of Wilson, so you can say whatever you want about him.
I don't know a huge amount about him, but I know that he resisted a lot of calls to join the war earlier. You know, again, when the ship was sunk in 1915, he was urged to join then. When news of the Belgian atrocities in 1914 were reported, he was urged to join then, and he kind of sort of batted it off until, well, until I think he had to, I think, until it became politically difficult, shall we say, for him not to join, you know, what was going on in Europe. So we've got 34 clauses of the armistice, and it's worth saying that the armistice is separate to the Treaty of Versailles.
Oh, definitely.
The armistice, obviously, at this point is stopping it. Should we say that this is maybe the bandage, but the Treaty of Versailles, should we say, is the stitches? You know, it's that one step further. But I mean, in brief, the 34 points, we don't have to go through all of them, but long, you know, of the basically, it's finish all hostilities on the Western Front within 6 hours. So, obviously, sign at 5, finish at 11. The Germans then had to evacuate much of Belgium, what was left of France, Belgium, Luxembourg, which was still completely controlled by the Germans, Luxembourg, and the Alsace-Lorraine territory, which is a very contentious part of the French and German border, where they both think that they should have it. I think it sits with the French these days.
Yeah, we French history podcast and I joke about that all the time. So it's always that point of contention in our friendship.
Indeed. And then there's surrender of weapons. There's a huge amount of weapons, rail carriages, road trucks that were to be surrendered. And again, then it's the withdrawal of troops. The Germans had to withdraw their troops from Romania, what were left in the Ottoman Empire, in Austro-Hungary, and the Russian Empire, back into what was German territory under 1914. And then, from the sea point of view, it was stopping all sea, you know, any sea warfare, no more sort of destroying of ships, and sort of the surrender of all submarines within 2 weeks, which is, you know, pretty short turnaround, really.
Yeah, especially considering those submarines could be out without reporting in. Now, at this point, they were probably trying to keep them on a shorter leash, knowing that the end was coming up. But still, 14 days is not a lot of time to get those back.
And that's pretty much it. It's all German troops out of anywhere but Germany, and give up all your weapons and ships and anything military is pretty much what that treaty, those 34 points, those 34 clauses talk about.
Yeah, and it is a technically an armistice, but it's definitely negating all the gains that Germany has made, and clearing their table of any bargaining tokens. They don't get to keep any of the territory they've taken. Their army is stripped. They're basically left at the mercy of the Allies with of the Entente expectation that a peace treaty will be formalized and that they'll still be able to negotiate at that peace treaty. They just
pretty clever, really, of the Entente to do that, to take off every form of negotiating power they have. So when they do go into the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, and they do sign the Treaty of Versailles, they haven't really got much option not to, because what's going to happen if they don't sign it? Well, I think, you know, Germany's, you know, the Entente are going to walk into Germany, you know, and that'll be that.
Yeah, they literally will have no choice. And I mean, at this point, even if they kept everything, they still aren't going to have much choice, thanks to the revolution that's currently causing quite a few problems for the new government. But yeah. Still, it's a calculated move for the Entente, and it works quite brilliantly when it comes time for the Treaty of Versailles the next year.
Absolutely. So, I mean, let's skip back forward from the signing to, you know, how different people around the world heard the news, should we say. So, I mean, from the, you know, from the British point of view, from the Entente point of view, there was Jim Fox, who was with the Durham Light Infantry, which is a place in England. He remembered sort of what happened up, you know, he says, of course, when the armistice was signed at 11 o'clock on the 11th November, as from 6 o'clock that morning, there was only the occasional shell that was sent by us over the German lines or the Germans over our lines. Maybe there was one an hour. And then about 10 a.m., one came down and killed a sergeant of ours who'd been out since 1915. He was killed with shrapnel, you know, thought that was very unlucky. To think he served since 1915, 3 years until 1918, nearly 4 years, and then to be killed within an hour of armistice. So that was one of the last, and I got another quote for how the soldiers were told that there was going to, because I think they were told pretty soon after the signing. And again, as you said, everyone knew it was coming. It had been pre-arranged that it was going to happen on that day. But I've got British Private William. He was told in a formal way that the column was marching. We had the bands with us then. It was open ground for a meadow on either side. And all of a sudden, horses galloped up. A band of horses galloped up with brass hats and all of this. And of course, we were told to halt, left turn and stand easy. The chief bloke, brass hat on his horse. He didn't get off his horse. None of them did. Then he waved his hands. Take it easy, sort of. And then he unrolled this long white document and he read out. He got a good voice. We could hear him. He read out the armistice was signed that morning at so and so place, gave the place. And he's stating that the hostilities will cease from 11 that morning. And of course, we had heard rumours for a couple of days that we'd really got Jerry on the run then. And of course, this didn't come as a surprise, and actually there wasn't a cheer of any kind raised when it was read out. And what about from the German side? We obviously, you've told, you know, a lot of them were sort of got up and, you know, just sort of walked away when it hit 11. Were they sort of told in the same sort of way? I mean,
there was a weird, it was kind of bittersweet. For the soldiers, there was happiness. Yes, it's over. It's done with. We can go home. There's this very interesting letter. It's written by a soldier who is making his way home. His name's Hensel, and he writes, "Dearest mother and dad, if only you all could see how glad everyone is in this place. Never in my life have I ever seen such happy people, for the 11th of November means the biggest thing possible to them all. Fighting has stopped. At last, the German people have awakened from their horrible dream. It's taken a long time, 4 years, and half of the sort of thing that France has been through is tremendous. And now it is all over. Why, it is almost too much for them to believe. The good folk are so happy, tears stand in their eyes, and they make no efforts to hide them, even those who have lost their dear ones. I was talking last night with a mother who gave her 2 boys and her husband, and now is all alone, who told me, why should I not be glad? My two boys and my good men are gone, it is true, but there are so many others. The war, it is finished, thanks to the good God. The whole town is decorated with flags and paper banners and streamers, and quite gaily. And at night, lanterns shine at every window and door. And so you get the sense that people are happy. You know, the war's over. There's still this, there's this bittersweetness that, yes, I've lost people. They're gone. And it's affecting everyone in Germany. I mean, Germany mobilizes millions of men. I'm going to say about half of them end up as some sort of casualty, prisoner, or dead by the end of the war.
It's amazing, really, from that point of view, is that at least in, and I don't know what it's like in the States with you, but when you're taught about World War One, and I suppose the general feeling is that Germany lost World War One, but as we're talking about here, and as you explain people with banners up and that sort of thing, it wasn't a loss as such. It was, you know, it was mutual surrender. It was two sides saying, we've both had enough. I think, you know, from the British, from the Germans, obviously the Germans had been asking, the Germans did, were the ones who asked for the armistice. They were the ones who initiated it. But from the Entente side, it was a case of that not going for an armistice and going for a surrender would involve an invasion, which was just going to prolong the misery for another year, 2 years.
Yeah, for the Germans, for the German government, everyone, they saw this as a mutual agreement that the fighting's over and that they're both were going to be equals. The Entente soldiers were probably seeing it the same way, but the leadership, of course, was definitely not on board with that idea. And as we saw with the armistice terms, they were making sure that Germany was not going to be an equal at any treaty table.
Mm. I mean, when the British public were notified of the armistice, it was done via the press bureau, via an official communique. At 10:20 in the morning, and David Lloyd George announced, he said, the armistice was signed at 5 o'clock this morning and hostilities are to cease on all fronts at 11 a.m. today. And it was the same for the Americans. The Americans did it at 2:30 p.m., which said, in accordance with the terms of the armistice, hostilities on the fronts of the American armies were suspended at 11 o'clock this morning. And I mean, you can see plenty of photos online about soldiers celebrating, American soldiers from the 64th Regiment celebrating, soldiers from, hospitals in Belgium celebrating with the nurses and people riding through trucks in Birmingham celebrating the armistice. And maybe it's a misconception I've had in my head for many years is, we weren't celebrating because we'd beaten Germany. We were celebrating because it was over. You know, for us, you know, for British soldiers, when soldiers went off, and I think war started in September 1914, something, I think it was September, we were told it was going to be over by Christmas. And it kind of was, but, you know,
just not the right year.
Actually, you know, and I suppose it's just this war weariness more than anything else. Maybe that's what they were celebrating. I don't know.
For Germany, everyone was kind of distracted around Armistice Day. We had this whole revolution going on,
And I mean, I have to admit, I mean, you know, I like to think I know my German history. I know a lot about Prussia, I know a lot about sort of Bismarck, Zollverein, and sort of the 1800s. And I know a lot about World War II. And I was for this, when we were doing this research, I was telling you, I was doing the research, I was Googling things, I was going, Armistice Day, Germany. And I was like, why can't I find any photos of, like, even just people walking around sad? You know, like, why can't I? Because, again, I still had this in my head that it was this kind of, the entente one, but it's not that, really. And I was looking around and I couldn't find anything. And all I could find was November Revolution. I was like, what's going on here then? And you're absolutely right. And it's something which I knew it happened, but I didn't realize it happened. It was happening basically as the war was going on, as the war was ending, and straight after the war, Germany was in the middle of a revolution.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, it's kind of the most unknown of the revolutions. Like, we all know the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution. The American Revolution is kind of popular over here. Shocker,
I know. Yeah, we've heard about that. Yeah.
And then you have your own revolutions and civil wars there in England. But the German Revolution is just kind of like, wait, that was a thing? That happened? For most people, they don't realize that. Yeah, Germany almost split up after World War One. It almost went back to being a weird collection of different national states.
Well, here's a question for you as a leading historian on Germany. Do you think that the 1918 revolution is just as important as the 1848 German revolutions?
Yes, the 1848 helps pave the way for a united Germany. It's where they start realizing, hey, we can come together, we can form a national identity. And Bismarck will really use that to his advantage later on.
There's a great book called 1848, The Year of Revolution, by Mike Rapport. Brilliant book, really talks about not only Germany, but it talks about Paris, Italy, Bucharest, all sorts of different places, because it was that year of revolution. But it's just interesting, because, again, that's what I thought when I saw revolution. I thought, well, they had their revolution in 1848, which obviously paved the way for a unified Germany.
For the 1918 one, and it goes into 1919 as well, it's very important because it sets the stage for the far right to rise. It is the battleground. 1918 and 1919 is the battleground between, you have the centralists who are trying to form the Weimar Republic and keep that running. You have the far left, who's usually supported by the Communist Russia. And then you have the far right, which usually has the backing of the military. And these three groups are constantly fighting each other through open warfare, such in Bavaria, through assassinations, such as the November killings. And then, of course, in the government itself, in the Weimar Republic. And it sets the stage for, unfortunately, what will become Nazi Germany
and World War II. Because after World War One, obviously Adolf Hitler served in World War One. He was a corporal, I think, or something in World War One in the trenches. And after World War One, he came to, and I want to say Munich is where he came to. And he worked for the military intelligence to gather information, because there was in Munich there was something crazy, like 40 different factions fighting each other for control. And I want to say Munich. I don't think it was Berlin. I think it was Munich.
Oh yeah, Bavaria. Bavaria briefly became a communist nation in 1919. Very briefly, but it was so factionalized that it kept switching government heads. Blink of an eye.
And that's where Hitler found the Nazi Party, which were known as the National Socialist Workers Party at the time, was because he was doing this military intelligence role. He was going to the beer kellers, and the National Socialists, they were based out of a quite famous beer hall known as Hofbräus in Munich. And he went to there, and that's where he saw people speak. And that was what it was in Munich. It was a lot of beer halls, but we what we'd have in the UK is the equivalent. It's like a working man's club, where people would go and they would listen to someone speak about something whilst drinking their beer. I was in Hofbräus earlier this year in Munich with my wife, and it's really cool. They've got these cages or lockers where you can lock your glass away. And so you don't have to bring your glass home, and you can leave it there in a locked cage. And they're sort of, you can't buy a space anymore. It's ones that have been passed down through the family years and years and years. It's a sort of a family tradition, which is, I think, it's quite sweet, really.
That's so cool. I haven't been able to make it to Bavaria yet. That's one of my goals, is to get there. Northern Germany is very beautiful, and so is Vienna. Bavaria is where everyone wants to go for tourism.
I've traveled to Berlin and Munich this year, and they are two very different places. Very, very, very different places. You would think they were different countries if you didn't know that they all speak in German. they're very different. They're very different people. They're very different. And they always have been. They've always been very, very, very different. But yeah, gorgeous, gorgeous part of the world. Munich's probably one of my favorite cities. I often think about a plate of Bratwurst and Weisswurst with Senf mustard. And a nice liter of beer. I'm thinking about it now, actually.
Going to do a quick jump over the channel, go see.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. You know, this revolution and this period of real disruption across Germany, where they're all sort of fighting for control. And in the end, I suppose in some ways, the Weimar Republic wins that kind of battle for power, should we say?
They do and they don't. They do win in the fact that they get their government's the one that survives that initial round, but the Weimar Republic had so many issues with it that it was just too easy for it to fall to other rivals later on down the road.
They survived the first line, but really, I suppose the Nazis won at the end of the day, didn't they? Really, from the sense that they were the ones who were in power. Well, not well. So 1919. So they're in power 1932. So sort of 13 years on. They're in control. Out of interest, and again, it's when we talk about sort of the far right parties in this sort of revolution, and you're saying these are sort of supported by the military. Are we seeing sort of these are sort of the higher up families, the Junkers, and that sort of thing? And when I say, I don't mean the current European. Gentlemen, I mean the old Junker class.
So initially what it came down to was basically, did you want the monarchy back? Did you want imperialism back? Did you want things to go back to the way they were pre-1914 for the right? And so there's this odd alliance of you have the military, you have the Free Corps, which is ex-military. Then you have those who are much more conservative or just simply anti-communist joining in with them to form this alliance that's either we want pre-1914 or we don't want communism and we don't trust the Republic to survive. And then on the left side, you have those who think that the Weimar Republic's not doing enough, or they want communism, and there's not an alliance building up there as much as on the right, but you do get groups working together, such as you'll have the Soviet-backed parties working with other communist parties who don't agree with Lenin's point of view, or with Democrats who want to keep the Weimar Republic but are willing to work more with a communist party. And so you have these coalitions forming, and the military overall backs the right because more often than not, they do want things the way It was pre-1914. And then a lot of them will switch over to support the Nazi Party because of how the Nazi Party pushes towards, hey, things were great as an empire, let's build up a new one.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, lots of talk about Bismarck and lots. I get that. You know, how much as well? I mean, obviously the Russian Revolution happened in 1917. Obviously the February Revolution, the October Revolution, this sort of civil war that sort of goes on for about 6 years from 1917. How much did that revolution influence what happened in Germany? You know, in the sense of, do you think if the Russian Revolution hadn't have happened, we wouldn't have seen it in Germany? Do you think people was, you know, they saw the Russians? Because, I mean, you know, the British almost had a communist revolution. Well, they were scared of it anyway. They were scared of it happening in Britain, which is why the Russian royal family weren't offered exile or they weren't offered refuge in Britain, because the royal family were worried that by taking them, it would cause a revolution. But did it impact Germany?
Oh, yes. By letting the cat out of the bag and showing that a communist government could be set up and could be a powerful government, it showed the communist sympathizers in Germany that, hey, if Russia can do it, we can do it too. And so they quickly jump on the coattails of the revolution. And what started out as the soldiers, as the sailors simply saying, hey, we don't want to go out to sea, quickly became a political statement of, hey, we don't want this government anymore. Let's form our own. Let's go and become communists like the Russians are doing. And the Soviets will actually help them. They'll send advisors. They'll send agents. They'll take advantage of German weakness and try to reestablish control over old parts of their empire. It becomes a major influence within the early part of the Weimar Republic's life.
And we're, you know, I suppose that's probably worth, it's probably worth moving on to talk about the Weimar and this. I don't know how to explain it really, in the sense of whether we call it a myth or whether we call it a theory. Of the November criminals, which was a term that was widely used in German circles, and it was widely and hugely exploited by Hitler and by the Nazis in their propaganda, of this idea that Germany wasn't losing. Germany could have fought on beyond the armistice, and that those people who signed it were traitors, and they were criminals against the German people. You know, when do we start hearing this term November criminal? Is it pretty much straight after?
So straight after, like right after the armistice has gone into effect, and people can actually take a moment and look it over, we start getting these newspapers and these articles start publishing this idea of being stabbed in the back, that, hey, we weren't losing this war. The army was actually still fighting in enemy territory. That means we were technically winning. We signed this armistice because we were betrayed. Someone stabbed us in the back at home. And so that idea slowly starts to grow. And it goes from being, you know, the sailors' revolt and the communists to being a conspiracy by Jews, by communists, by anyone who is not part of the right or the military. And it gets to the point that anyone who had a role in the government during this time is considered a traitor. And so we get these November criminals starting to pop up as the far right starts to gain power, and they select them as targets.
Well, this is it, and you sort of, you know, because everyone needs a scapegoat, don't they? When you're trying to build a populist movement, you've got to have someone to blame. And I suppose that's where that started. But I mean, the German revolt, it starts with the sailors' revolt, as you said, which, as you said, is pretty much, again, sailors who are sort of objecting to, you know, going out to sea. more than anything. Do you want to explain that a bit more?
Yeah, so it's towards the end of the war, and the Germans are trying to improve their position at the negotiating table. And so it's decided that they're going to do one last throw of the dice with the Navy. They were going to send their fleet out and try to break the blockade. And if they could do so, first of all, they could bring in some necessary supplies and get some needed food and material that they had sorely been missing. But also, it would hopefully make the Entente be more willing to negotiate with now that they no longer held their trump card. And so these plans are all set up, and the sailors hear about it, and they flat out refuse. They know the ending's coming, and they don't want to go out and die. They don't want to go fight for what they realize is just a pointless battle, when they could stay here and just wait it out until negotiations are finished. And so it starts out as a small mutiny, and it just grows and it grows. And eventually the sailors call for outside support, and it just goes from this small revolt and mutiny to this massive revolution that shakes Germany to its core.
And the revolution, again, is predominantly the Weimar Republic. It's the old imperial, conservatives and the Freikorps, which are sort of these nationalist militias against this communist or socialist. It's the Spartacus League, isn't it? And that sort of those sort of socialist, communist, Marxist movements that are sort of fighting for that revolution.
And they actually, especially the Freikorps, they will send out troops to go fight in neighboring countries as well. And so the German military, even though it's disbanded and they become these Freikorps, they will actually still be involved in Poland, in the Baltic states, all trying to just stem the tide of the Russian communist soldiers who will invade later on.
I think from there, because we're talking, obviously we got the January the January uprising, or the Spartacist uprising. You've got the sailors' revolt.
So the emperor abdicates his position November 9th, 1918. 1918. It was a power play by the Germans in hopes that by showing the Entente that they were setting up a democratic government, they would be more willing to negotiate. And so they convinced the emperor to abdicate, and then they set up this this democratic government 2 days before the armistice is going to be signed, in hopes that, hey, we're now like you. We are a democracy. Go easy on us. It doesn't work, but it's a ploy by them to do it. And then after the war is over and the armistice and the Treaty of Versailles has failed them, a lot of them go, you know what, we want the emperor back. But this was a mistake. And there's not going to be that far right that tries to get the emperor to come back all the way up through the Nazi regime.
And I suppose this is just one of the factors. You have the armistice, you have this communist uprising or Marxist uprising, you've got the emperor who abdicates, and then you've got probably at the very end of that, what I was thinking of was the Treaty of Versailles, which was, I think that was signed in June.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1919.
So the Treaty of Versailles, as we talked about earlier, it kind of cripples Germany, where they are made to accept the blame for the First World War. And there's a huge amount of reparations. Something along the lines of about 22 billion pounds or $35 billion or 27 billion euros in current money. And it was only in 2010 that the Germans paid off all of its war debt.
Yep. It took them a while.
Well, yeah. Those are some good terms, they are, to get a loan for that period of time. Well,
they never even got to negotiate those terms either. They spent the entire time the Treaty of Versailles was being hammered out, waiting never knowing what was happening until the day that they had to come in and sign it.
Yeah, you know, so it was basically handed to them on the 28th of June, 1919. And it was signed and it was brought into effect the following year, on the 10th of January, 1920. And, you know, out of all of these things, and it's because, you know, we're talking about next steps, aren't we? We're talking that World War One and all these things, it led to World War Two. It led to the troubles that Germany would really have over the next 70 years when you think long term about it. But, you know, people always say it was the Treaty of Versailles. That was the reason that Hitler had the chance to build this this populist movement, because the Entente far too harsh on Germany. You know, the French were coming in and they were driving to factories in the Rhine and they were looting the factories, which did happen. They would regularly, at least for the first couple of years after the Treaty of Versailles was signed, they would come in and they would take what they wanted and sort of leave again as part of this sort of reparation payment approach. But is the Treaty of Versailles as important to what happened next for Germany?
So what I always like to say is the Treaty of Versailles isn't the cause for the rise of the Nazi Party in World War II. It's a cause. Because people always go, oh, yep, Treaty of Versailles immediately means we're going to have World War II. No, there are other factors that are involved. You have to deal with the fact that, you know, the far right comes out of the German Revolution still powerful enough. You have the beer hall push, where Hitler not only doesn't die, but he also doesn't serve his sentence like he's supposed to.
Yeah, that was good publicity. That was a big publicity for him as well, wasn't it?
Exactly. And there's all these other factors that lead to the rise of Nazi Germany that you can't just go and point at the Treaty of Versailles and say, it's because of you all this happened. Now, it does play a role in that, and it plays a large role in like how Russia was formed, how the Middle East was formed, decolonization, all of that. It has a hand in, but we can't just point at it and say, we can blame everything in our world to you guys back there.
I mean, you know, you are talking, you know, you mentioned a few factors there, but Hindenburg obviously had a big role in this, in the sense that, you know, towards the end, he really shouldn't have been in a position of power. I think he had dementia, or he was definitely on his way out towards the end. And I think, you know, Hitler was able to sneak through in there. Von Papen certainly played his part in getting Hitler into power. But, you know, some people say it goes as far back as, you know, the 1800s, that you know, some of the reasons why this was still not fixed, you know what I mean? But in a percentage-wise, what would you say Treaty of Versailles was? How responsible for it, would you say?
It's a good question, isn't it? Yeah, it's a very good question. Now, thinking about it, I mean, you want to give it high, because a lot of things that do happen, you can tie back to it. So I'd say that it's, I want to say it's probably around anywhere from 40 to 50%.
I was going to say about 50 to 60% myself, because I agree there are other factors. It's interesting to hear from you, obviously, your thoughts on it as well. So I mean, that is a such Armistice Day in Germany, in Britain, as we've already said, and in the Allied front, on the Entente front, it was very much a celebration. There wasn't Britain's sort of, at least from the British point of view, after World War One, there's a lot of rebuilding to be done. Obviously, we've lost a huge amount of our male population. One of the most interesting things I find about World War One is the role of women in Britain. So I'm not really sure where things were at with Germany. at the end of World War One, or what sort of the vote looked like, whether German women had the vote in that 1914 or 1918. But for women in World War One, women didn't have the right to vote at the beginning of World War One. It was restricted very much to certain kind of women who were allowed to vote, and it was still mainly a male dominated arena, politics and actually being politically involved. But in World War One, because obviously all the men were away fighting, women who were working to some extent before World War One, but were en masse brought in to work in the factories. Women were mainly used to work in sort of textile manufacturing before the war, but since 1915, as the need for shells and ammunition was required, women began to work in the factories that the men couldn't operate because they were over in France and Belgium. And by 1918, a million women were employed in munitions work in World War One, in the UK, which I think's, you know, pretty interesting, really. You know, there were women police officers, women working in the transport industry. You know, there was about 50,000 people who worked on the railway for women. And women were working in dangerous conditions, probably for the first time ever. And it was the first time, really, that women's role outside of the domestic environment was really accepted. And women did a lot, you know, from that point of view. But as soon as the war ended, and that's probably actually worth saying, is in February 1918, women over the age of 30 and men over the age of 21 were given the right to vote. All women, but quite a lot of women. Mm-hmm. As soon as the war ended, women were told to go back into the homes, that they were stealing men's jobs by staying in the factories. And women were forced back into, you know, to not wanting to use a kind of an idiom or a colloquialism, they were forced back into the kitchen. They were first forced back into looking after children, as then men took those jobs back. And then we sort of see this women having a lot of power during the war, and then it literally just disappearing completely until World War II, where they're expected again to do the same, to work in the factories because the men are abroad. And it's only really after World War II that things really start to change for women's rights. And I think if we hadn't have had those wars, the at least the female movement for universal suffrage probably wouldn't be where it is today.
Oh, definitely. For the Germans, it's before the war, women's rights had seen some improvements. I mean, still didn't have the right to vote. They were still seen as the weaker of the two genders, but they had made some gains. And during the war itself, they would get access to jobs. They would be able to explore different roles that hadn't been available to them before the war. But when democratic reforms were starting to be put in place by the emperor, such as in 1917, he never really pushed for women to have the right to vote. He didn't see it as necessary in order to get the support he needed. So he's just saying, yes, more men can vote. You can have more rights there. It's not until towards the end, and there's signs that a democratic government's going to be set up, that women's rights are for votes really start to be focused on. And so I believe it's right after the signing of the armistice they get the right to vote. I think I'm going to say it's the next day.
Wow.
No, I'm sorry. November 12th is just when the legal basis is set up.
Is there any kind of like restriction on age at all, or is it any women over the age of like 18 can vote then? Because obviously we still said you got to be over 30, you know, so we don't want young women to vote. Goodness, that would be terrifying. We only want sort of, you know, older women to vote. Was it kind of, you know, the same for men and women then?
So for them, it was same as men, 20 years of age, and it went into effect November 30th. So it passed the 20th, and it was in effect for the 30th of November. So they had the same voting rights as the guys did.
That's incredible. I mean, I've just done some Googling while you've been talking about it, because I've never thought of, you know, universal suffrage in other countries apart from the UK. Obviously, number 10, we will be talking about it quite a lot in the next couple of, but in about 100 years time for the number 10 podcast. But, you know, still, I think ahead. But Germany was at the front of female representation compared to Britain, where, you know, there was only 2.1% of MPs, members of parliament, were female. You had 6.7% in 1926. 6% of women, which again is still a long way.
Nowhere near. They're 50% of the population, but yes.
Still, I mean, in America, it's 1%.
Yep.
1% in America, 2% in the UK, and 6%, almost 7%, which is pretty. It's pretty fair play, you know. It's but again, I suppose that kind of drew itself back in again, didn't it? You know, with when the Nazis sort of began to take power, women were kind of moved into that kind of that, you know, it's that old German saying, isn't it, Kinder, Kuka, Kirche, you know, children, kitchen, church. Those are the responsibilities for women. Still, I always find it interesting. I've always found some of the suffragette movement, the female universal suffrage, very, very interesting, especially how it was affected by a lot of men not being there to stop them, I suppose, is probably the best way of putting it.
Yeah, the women's suffrage movement in the U.S. actually has some deep ties to Germany, thanks to the fact that they are able to use the war as a turning point. They don't get their rights to vote until 1919-1920. So they're way behind Britain and Germany, but they're able to use the war to get more jobs, to help turn the focus on German Americans, which will also help with their prohibition movement later on down the road. And it really improves their lot, which had just been a constant uphill struggle for the last couple of decades to get any sort of rights at all.
Because it was Wilson who, although sort of he actually favored women's suffrage in America, he very much pushed it. He believed it was a state issue, not a federal issue. So he kind of just, you know, pushed it down the road, really, because the South were obviously very much opposed to women's rights back then. It's very interesting. And again, I don't want to go off on a tangent too much, but obviously back in those times, the South was actually Democrat. There was the 1950s where things really started to change, but like New York used to be like a Republican state, and it's been turned on its head in the last sort of 50, 60 years compared to where it is now.
Yeah, it's been a weird ride for for the U.S. politics, to be sure. But what is Armistice Day for Britain now?
Yeah, so I mean, we're obviously recording Sunday the 10th. So, funnily enough, this morning in my local village, there was a parade through the village, through the high street, to the church. There was a service in the church for World War One, and we had sort of like the scouts there. We had cadets from the sort of the army cadets there, as well as veterans who have served in all kinds of conflicts. You know, obviously there are no World War One surviving soldiers or veterans left now, and there's very few World War Two, but we got a lot of people from the Falklands and a growing number from Afghanistan and Iraq and the Gulf War conflicts. So there's a parade. The roads are closed. I was sort of in the very cold today, manning some of the road closures in the village. And that's what it is for us. It's parades. It's usually around church, and then what we do, at least in our village, is we go to the memorial. We used to have a military hospital where in the village I live in, and they lay the wreaths at either the memorials or the in our case it's the military hospital, and do a roll call or a call of honor where they say the names of every soldier from the village who died in World War One and the World War Two conflicts. As you can imagine, that takes quite a bit of time. And that's pretty much it. We wear poppies. Do you guys wear poppies in the States?
Mm-mm. You have it. Continue, sorry.
It's Veterans Day in the States, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. We call it Veterans Day here.
Yeah, so we wear a poppy, which is usually made of like a red paper to symbolize the flower of the poppy. And we wear that on our lapels, on our shirts, usually in a couple of days leading up to Armistice Day or Remembrance Day, as we call it. And that's to symbolize the poppies that grew in Flanders fields and a lot of the fields across the French and Belgian battlefields, because there was an unnatural amount of flowers and growth to the poppies after the war because of the amount of blood that's going into the ground to richen the soil. And they've sort of been very much seen as a symbol of World War One. A couple of years ago, the Tower of London, which is one of our probably most famous monuments in the UK, in London, there's a moat around the Tower of London castle, and they put thousands of poppies around the moat. It looked absolutely fantastic. But that is for us. It's remembrance, it's parades, it's laying of poppy wreaths and wreaths of flowers to remember those that have died, those soldiers who have died. There's a movement which is growing in the UK as well, where people wear white poppies instead of red poppies, and that's to symbolize the belief. It's kind of the belief that we shouldn't just be celebrating or remembering, is probably a better word. We shouldn't just be remembering the soldiers who died. We should be remembering the soldiers and the civilians that are the victims of war. It's very much kind of not trying to glorify war, is that kind of movement. But yeah, that's pretty much Remembrance Day here. What about you guys in the States?
So for the US, it can be different from place to place. We do have parades. Some towns will do parades. Some towns will do something special for the veterans. And some places, like churches and so forth, will have a special service for their veterans. But for the most part, most people just go around like it's a typical Monday. There, you can see on Facebook and on Twitter and other places where veterans and their families will post things. But there's nothing that's unified that the entire nation does on that day. It's still better. Germany doesn't celebrate Armistice Day remembers Armistice Day on November 11th like the rest of us do, because it has a bad taste in their mouth.
I don't know how much you've got on this, but I actually found a letter written by, I don't know if you saw this, it's written by the Deutsche Welle editor, with Deutsche Welle being like a magazine newspaper in Germany, and it was written by their editor, Zolvika Abney, and he talks about modern remembrance in Germany. Did you see this? Or I don't know if I sent this to you before.
I think you did.
I'll read it to you, and you sort of tell me if there's anything more to it. But this is the letter that he wrote sort of a couple of years ago in the newspaper. So Germany's own Remembrance Day, which is called Volkstrauertag, is November 13th. The 65 people killed during both world wars will be commemorated in the Federal Parliament in Berlin to remember all victims of war and violent oppression, including civilians who suffered under totalitarian violence. It's logical that the German capital is restrained in the way it remembers war, not wanting to glorify any part of its disastrous military past or offers symbols that could fire nationalistic sentiment. I noticed this when wandering through Unter den Linden, which is a street in Berlin. I stumbled into Neue Wache, a former Prussian guardhouse recast as the central memorial for the victims of war and tyranny. In the 1920s, the Neue Wache was a more controversial war memorial dedicated to German soldiers who fell during World War I. But after the fall of the Nazi regime, the East German communist government rededicated the imposing classical structure to victims of fascism and militarism. The changing semantics of the monument well illustrate the politics of memorialising war in Berlin. The focus of the Neue Wache memorial is a sombre, squat statue. The mother with her dead son by Kathy Kalwitz, which sits alone in the dark space, lit only by a saintly beam of daylight issuing from a hole in the roof. The memorial is powerful because of its bleakness, but also its tranquility, its message of peaceful redemption from a universal horror. There is no mention of bravery or heroism, sentiments I tend to attach to war memorials as native of the Allied world. It seems any glaring tribute to war is quickly vandalized in Berlin, as is the case with the stone sculpture of a naked kneeling man in Kreuzberg, a rare symbol of falling and missing comrades of both world wars, which has been splashed with red paint out of protest. It takes some time to notice the very subtle ways Berlin tries to remember those 21st century wars in which it played a very large part. Only last week, I literally stumbled across a stone obelisk hemmed by trees in the corner of a random suburban park, two small stones either side commemorating the First and Second World War. An ominous message is inscribed on the large rough boulder, a reminder the victims of the wars and all tyranny. Blink and I would have missed it. But the power of this monument lies in the universality of its message, the poignancy to find it. Not rammed down, but hidden in some bushes. A muted cry from the city that ushered the world into two monstrous wars and which still partly lives with that guilt. Berlin won't officially remember Armistice on November 11th, but look closer and you'll realise the city never forgets. And I think that's a brilliant, I think it sums it up perfectly. Mm.
It does. For the Germans, the entire month of November is called Toten Monat, which is the Dead Month. Yeah. And it's just, it's in remembrance of the dead. It's they focus each year the day changes because it's based off of this like second Sunday before Advent. But each year they celebrate this Volkstrauertag. And it's changed. Initially, it was about those who died during World War I. And then when the Nazis came, they moved the date, and they made it about commemorating the heroes, saying, "Hey, these guys sacrificed for us. We need to do the same." Which, of course, after the war was completely frowned upon because it was supporting these nationalist feelings, and yeah. So it switched to a focus on remembrance of the dead, but also of the dead caused by Germany. And this was in East Germany where this was set up. And nowadays, they've reconfigured it to a day remembering their dead, remembering those that they have caused the death of in both world wars, and for all of those who have died due to tyranny and due to oppression. And it's a very somber affair. It's Usually, they'll have small little remembrances for all their veterans at the small towns and so forth. But in the capital, it's not a parade. It's simply a speech given by the president in front of the entire government, followed by the national anthem, and that's it. They don't do any major parades or celebrations. It's simply a reminder of this is our past. This is where we were. We need to make sure we never go back there.
And I think that's very true. Again, as I said, I was in Berlin earlier this year, sort of February time, and it sounds a bit silly, but I went on one of these sort of beer bike things, where they're sort of like two tables, everyone cycles, and there's a guy who drives it. And we were a couple other people, but I was sitting right next to the driver, who was a native to Berlin, had lived through the wall and everything like that. And we were talking about it, about how these sorts of things are remembered, and they still, that there is still a guilt there, despite it's not them, you know, it's not those people, it might be some of their relatives and that. There is still this, and I don't even know if guilt's the right word for it, at least if they use it, whether they should use the word guilt, but it's this need to remember, not talk about it. There's no need to talk about it. There's no need to bring it up, but it can't be forgotten, I think, is very much a feeling that at least the gentleman I was talking to, as I went around Berlin on a beer bike, there was definitely something he was very clear about, that everyone knows about it. Everyone knows the past, and everyone knows that it can't happen again.
Yeah, that is very much the sentiment with this day. It's very much nowhere near the same as the way we remember it. We remember the sacrifices for the world that we live in now, compared to the Germans who remember the sacrifices that they have caused with these two world wars.
No, I think it's different in a lot of places. I mean, I think for, I'm not sure if we do it so much for Armistice Day, but I think we do also do something with France as well. You know, there'll be some sort of we go over to France to sort of some of their monuments as well, and lay wreaths and have sort of parades or memorials, really, isn't it? That's key of what it is.
Yes, I'm not too sure, but I'm for the French themselves. But Armistice Day is probably a large event in their public mind, because it was fought mainly on their soil for 4 years. So.
Yeah, very much so. But yeah, it's that is, you know, that is Armistice Day. I think we've done a good job.
Yeah, I'd say we covered it pretty well. Even went and talked about some other topics.
It's good, and it shows that we should come together again soon and do another one.
Oh, definitely would love to. There's plenty of topics dealing between German and British relations throughout the entirety of the history. Would you like to tell my listeners a little bit about your show?
Of course. Yeah, no, that'd be great. So the Number 10 podcast is a British history podcast. We're also a politics podcast as well. So the main thing with our history is we go through British prime ministers from the very first one, which is Sir Robert Walpole in 16 tw or sorry 1721, and then we go sort of in historical order through to the modern day, and we talk about the events that happen. But we also do a lot of political episodes as well. So we talk about modern global politics. We talk about events that are happening around the world. We talk about things like Armistice Day. We were talking about the Hong Kong protests last season, and I'm currently on season break, but I'll be returning later this month. This is probably going to be the first episode back, I'd say, for me. But yeah, so we do a whole host of things, but it's debate and it's history. That's what we kind of we talk about, and we try not to talk about Brexit too much as well.
Yeah, can't blame you on that one.
Yeah, no, I can't. We can't. Yeah, but Jacob, please tell us about, tell my listeners about your show.
Sure. So it's the podcast on Germany. You can find us on iTunes and Spotify and all the other places. We do the entire history of Germany, starting from the very beginning. So pre-written history, what we've been able to find in the area, and we're going to go all the way to modern day. We're in our second year, and we just finished up the Battle of Teutoburg Forest and the fall of the Roman German provinces. So please come join us for that. It's going to be a long road. I mean, we just hit the 80s and we're in our second year already. So looking forward to seeing you guys.
Fab. You know, and as I say, I'd love to do this again. I love doing stuff with other podcasts. And I've been a big fan of your podcast for a long time. As I say, from myself at the Number 10 podcast and Jacob from Podcasts on Germany. Thank you very much for listening. Jacob, thank you for
thank you.
Wasting 2.5 hours with me.
That was quite worth it, I assure you. That's, I look forward to doing another.
Yes, indeed. And thank you very much all for listening. Bye-bye.